On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, An Improved Understanding of LNAPA Behavior in the Subsurface, State of Science versus State of the Practice. Today's training was developed by the ITRC LNAPA team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. On slide two, a few housekeeping items to cover. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end. For our phone line participants, for questions that you want to ask out loud, we do ask that you hold those until the question and answer breaks. Anyone is welcome to use that orange question mark at the top of the slides to send in questions or comments throughout the training, and we'll ask as many questions as we can during the question and answer break. We are recording today's training, and we offer archives of past ITRC training classes. As we move through the slides today, each of you in the audience is in control. So the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate, and most often you're going to be using that third button to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. And we're going to say the slide number as we go through today. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. So if you do have to leave before we wrap up, please fast forward to that last slide and follow the link to the feedback form. We really appreciate you providing us information, and we do use your feedback. We also have available a new feature. In addition to getting an email confirmation, you can also get a certificate of participation. To get that, you have to fill out the feedback form, and near the bottom of the feedback form is the place where you can check to get that certificate. This is the only way to get a certificate. So if you forget to check the feedback box at the very bottom, you need to just go back and fill out the feedback again. I don't have another way of getting you a certificate. It's only through the feedback form and if you check that box at the bottom. On slide three, more information about ITRC is available at the ITRC website. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. We include our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents. We have our training schedule for 2016 laid out, including classroom training on LNAPL. So if you are interested in more training on LNAPL and petroleum vapor intrusion, it is available in the classroom training format. There's also opportunity for a new LNAPL update team, so I recommend that you learn more on the ITRC website. On slide five, I'll introduce our trainers for today. Eric Gessert is a supervisor of the Petroleum Remediation Program for the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. He focuses on incorporating state-of-the-science technologies into the program, including advanced characterization techniques and conceptual site model development. Sanjay Garg is a consultant within Shell Global Solutions in Houston, Texas, which provides technical expertise to Shell Global Operations. He provides technical support on underground fate and transport of hydrocarbons, including LNAPL management. Ian Hurst is a senior associate engineer with Golder Associates, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. He is a technical specialist in the areas of LNAPL and DNAPL source characterization, monitored natural attenuation and source zone depletion, vapor intrusion, and vapor phase in-situ remediation technologies. On slide five, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Eric Gessert at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Eric?
Thank you very much, Juliana. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, well, this internet-based training was one of the many products that were developed by the ITRC LNAPL team. This team formed in July of 2007, and as the pie chart shows on slide five, it was a very collaborative effort between state regulators, federal agencies, consultants, as well as industry representatives. And, of course, the focus of this group was to really present and develop what is the state of the science as it pertains to LNAPL. Moving on to slide six. So why exactly did ITRC form an LMAPL team? As I'm sure you all on the line are aware, LMAPL is present at thousands of sites throughout the country, and often has several technical as well as regulatory challenges that it presents. Regulatory agencies typically have a backlog of LMAPL sites that are not effectively reaching an endpoint, and so that was one of the clear objectives of this ITRC LMAPL team, was to try to better guide and develop a good methodology for characterizing and addressing LMAPL concerns. And then that last bullet on slide six kind of points to the difficulties that various implementing agencies have in addressing LMAPL, that question of what exactly does it mean to remove free product to the maximum extent practicable. We'll get into that a little bit more, but implementing agencies have had various definitions of what maximum extent practicable means, and that has, of course, led to just different ways that sites are assessed and ultimately closed throughout the country. Moving on to slide seven. So the ITRC LMAPL team developed a couple of documents that were published in 2009. The first document, which is available on the ITRC website, as is the second document, the first document is titled Technology Overview Document on LMAPL Natural Source Zone Depletion. The second document is titled LMAPL Technical Regulatory Guidance Document, which provides a framework for selecting remedial technologies to address LMAPL concerns. In addition to these documents, once those were developed, the internet-based training began in 2010. As Juliana had mentioned, this internet-based training is broken into three parts. Today is part one. Parts two and three will be given next week. In addition to the internet-based training, there has been an LMAPL classroom training, which has been ongoing beginning in 2011, and there are classes, or currently there's one class which is scheduled for 2016, and that will be presented in more detail in a subsequent slide. The last thing I wanted to point out, definitely happy to announce that there is a new ITRC LMAPL update team, which was recently announced on the ITRC website, so you can certainly find more information about that team on the website. But this team is actively developing its members for that team, and the first team get-together will be at the ITRC spring meeting, which is this April in Minneapolis. Moving on to slide eight. So this is an overview of what we'll be covering today in part one of the internet-based training, and essentially it's an understanding of LMAPL behavior in the subsurface. We are going to present factors that control LMAPL distribution and behavior in the subsurface, and then we're going to get into the concept of LMAPL saturation, and what does it mean when saturations are greater than residual saturation levels, and what does it mean when saturations are less than residual saturation levels. Moving on to slide nine. Part two, which is going to be presented next Tuesday, and as Juliana mentioned, definitely recommended that you take parts one, two, and three of the internet-based training. So part two is next Tuesday, and that's going to get more into LMAPL characterization and recoverability. There will be a decent amount of time dedicated to developing and describing an LMAPL conceptual site model. We're going to get into soil and LMAPL characteristics that influence recovery. We are going to get into an evaluation of hydraulic recovery of LMAPL. And then once we have that conceptual site model developed, we are then going to look at what are our goals and objectives, our cleanup objectives, based off of our LMAPL concerns. Part two concludes with an introduction to some of the remedial technologies that are presented in that 2009 Remedial Technology Selection Framework document. Moving on to slide 10. The last part of the internet-based training takes place next Thursday, and that will in more detail review the technologies for remediation of LMAPL. The 2009 Evaluating LMAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals, that essentially reviews 17 different technologies that have been identified as being applicable to addressing LMAPL concerns. In addition to those technologies, that document provides a very good remedial decision-making framework. It provides an overview, a detailed overview of the technologies, and then it goes into, again, once your concerns and objectives are identified, you then begin a remedial technology screening and evaluation process. Once you've gone through that remedial technology screening and evaluation process, you may have a technology or two that may be applicable to address your LMAPL concerns. And then that's where you go into what are the data requirements that can really help further evaluate the applicable technologies and ultimately select the technology. And those data requirements may include pilot testing, bench scale testing, soil oxidant demand, things of that nature that are specific to the technology that has been selected. And then lastly, in the Evaluating LMAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals technical guidance document, there are case studies that are provided. Moving on to slide 11. As I mentioned, there is a two-day LMAPL training class that has been ongoing since 2011 and is continuing this year. As of now, there is one training class that has been identified in the Atlanta area, which is April 5th and 6th of 2016. Registration for that class is still open, and these internet-based training series are really recommended participation prior to taking the class. It certainly is a benefit being one of the trainers in that class. You know, when the audience in those classes has taken a part of the internet-based training, we kind of have a higher platform that we're starting from. There is a potential for another 2016 class, and ITRC is currently considering where a location may be. Moving on to slide 12. Slide 12 is an overview of what we will be presenting today, and it's broken into four sections. I will be going over section one, which is essentially what are LMAPL definitions and what are LMAPL concerns. I will then turn it over to Sanjay, who will go into how LMAPL enters soil and groundwater. Section three is then how LMAPL distributes vertically. And then the last section is how LMAPL moves. And as Juliana had indicated, there will be a question and answer session in the middle of this presentation as well as the end of the presentation. So moving on to slide 13, what exactly is LMAPL? Well, by definition, LMAPL is an immiscible organic liquid that is less dense than water. And I'm sure a lot of you on the line are familiar with both LMAPL and DMAPL. The difference between the two is, of course, that DMAPL is more dense than water. DMAPL is largely made up of your chlorinated solvents. DMAPL will not be covered during this internet-based training. So getting back to LMAPL, LMAPL, of course, can be single-phase or single components. You know, you could just have an LMAPL body made up of toluene, for example, or it could be a mixture of components such as gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, or crude oil. As this image on slide 13 depicts, LMAPL is less dense than water, and in a glass, when given time to partition, it, you know, readily floats on top of the water. We will certainly be going into, when we get into how LMAPL enters soil and groundwater, that the model of LMAPL simply floating on top of water is an incorrect model. And so we will be discussing that in detail today. Moving on to slide 14. So the concept of LMAPL saturation and residual saturation. If you've ever been to one of the training classes or potentially you're going to go to the Atlanta training class, this is the time where a lot of people get wet when the presenter actually goes through this model. But a good way to think of L-MAPL saturation is to think of the saturation of water in a sponge. So looking at the upper left figure, you can see that, just imagine that if you submerged a sponge in water and just pulled that sponge out of water, water would freely drain from the sponge pores. It will freely drain for a period of time. And then if you apply a little bit of pressure, of course, more water will continue to release itself from the sponge. So that is analogous to what L-MAPL saturations are when they are above the residual saturation range. Ultimately, you can continue to apply pressure to that sponge. You know, you can really squeeze it hard, and you'll keep getting some water to freely drain from that sponge. But there's going to be a period in time where you can no longer squeeze out any liquid from the sponge, but the sponge is still damp. It still has moisture content within the pores of that sponge. That is analogous to what the residual saturation level is. When L-MAPL saturations are less than the residual saturation, they do not freely move between the soil pores, but they will remain there regardless of efforts to try to to physically or hydraulically remove it. Moving on to slide 15, here's a simplified L-MAPL conceptual site model for a gasoline release site. One thing I like to think of when discussing L-MAPL is that every gasoline release site begins as L-MAPL. There are a lot of sites where, you know, we don't observe L-MAPL in a monitoring well, for example, but that does not mean that L-MAPL is not there. So looking at this conceptual site model of an L-MAPL release, it identifies what are the various concerns that L-MAPL presents. You can see that there is the vapor phase, which emanates off of the L-MAPL body, the volatile portion of the L-MAPL body. And a dissolve phase will also result from the soluble components of the L-MAPL. So this is a generalized, good image to think about when imagining an L-MAPL release from an underground storage tank. If we move to slide 16, we're going to go into a bit more detail of a soil pore scale L-MAPL distribution. L-MAPL shares available pores with both soil vapor and water. So we can see in the vado zone, which is depicted by image A, that largely the soil pores are occupied by soil gas in that area, but there is some residual L-MAPL which remains hung up in the vado zone, but most of it drains via gravity processes on down through the subsurface. When we get to the capillary fringe area, we can see that the wetting fluid, the water, typically surrounds the soil particles, and that the L-MAPL, as well as some air, occupy the remainder of the soil pore area. Image C depicts an area of high L-MAPL saturation, where we can see that there is a larger or a higher percentage of L-MAPL saturation in that immediate source area. Image D depicts where we are transitioning to more water occupying those soil pores, but there are L-MAPL globules or ganglia which do show up as we start moving away from the source area. And then lastly, image A, this is where we're largely dealing with dissolve phase contamination in groundwater from the soluble components of L-MAPL. So, you know, the large thing to remember here is that, one, L-MAPL shares its soil pores with both groundwater and soil vapor, and that two, L-MAPL does not occupy 100% of the available soil pores. Moving on to slide 17. This is a really good slide when thinking about what do we do when we have an LMAP release. Qualifying what are our concerns with LMAP. And we break down those concerns into two predominant categories, compositional concerns and saturation concerns. Compositional concerns, may be flammable or explosive conditions with the petroleum hydrocarbon. And, of course, you have these soluble components. And every LMAP body, depending on what the source was, has different soluble components that we're concerned with. The most common one that I can think of is gasoline. You are concerned with, benzene as a soluble component of gasoline. Vapor intrusion, of course, the volatile components within the LMAP body may present vapor intrusion issues. And just this past year, well, actually it was 2014 now, I guess, but ITRC put out a petroleum vapor intrusion guidance document. And it was very important to distinguish between petroleum vapor intrusion and what historically has just been called vapor intrusion because of the distinct characteristics of biodegradation that occurs with petroleum products. So those are examples of the compositional concerns. And then we have saturation concerns with LMAP. LMAP may migrate to new areas, which could cause or create new human health or environmental risks. It could get into utilities, basements, surface waters, and it could lead to the longevity of dissolved-phased or vapor-phased plumes. So when we talk about saturation concerns, and over the course of the three-day or the three-part internet-based training, we will really get into some good recoverability metrics when we have saturation concerns associated with LMAP. And then lastly, where is it? During part two of the internet-based training, we will really get into developing that conceptual site model and, again, as I identified, evaluating recoverability metrics. Moving on to slide 18, regulatory framework. Well, the last slide did a really good job of really helping governing bodies identify what are the concerns and how are we going to go about addressing the concerns associated with LMAP. I'm happy to say that over the course since this ITRC LMAP team developed in 2007, 20 states within the United States have adopted some form of the methodology that's identified in the ITRC training. Prior to that training, there really was no clear regulatory framework with dealing with LMAP. And specifically hydraulic recovery efforts associated with LMAP. As I mentioned before, that term, free product removal to the maximum extent practicable, that is what's defined in the Code of Federal Regulations, and it is then the implementing agencies that have to interpret what maximum extent practicable means. As a part of what this team did up front, we canvassed all of the states within the country to get a sense of what kind of definitions do we have for maximum extent practicable. Some of it meant removing all LMAP to pre-release conditions. Some of it meant a measurable thickness within a monitoring well. Some of them are risk-based, and others had no clear requirements. So you can see how this sort of led to confusion and really prolonged LMAP sites with no clear endpoints in mind. And again, as I stated, the guidance that ITRC has put forward has really helped almost half of the country come up with more concrete ways to address LMAP. Moving on to slide 19, here's kind of a depiction of what regulations do well and what regulations could potentially do a bit better. When we look at image one, which shows immediate LMAP concerns, explosive vapors in confined spaces, most all governing bodies have clear, action that needs to be taken when we have explosive conditions. Looking at the second column, which identifies dissolved phase concerns as well as vapor intrusion concerns, we also have pretty clear guidance on what to do when we have those dissolved phase or vapor phase concerns. We have dissolved phase maximum contaminant levels, and we also have a lot of states have some pretty clear, vapor intrusion guidance. And again, the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Team is really helping advance, good practices for vapor intrusion guidance. What regulatory bodies could really continue to use assistance with is LMAPL migration issues as well as recoverability potential of LMAPL, and that is something that we will be getting into more detail over the next couple days. The last slide I'm going to present is slide 20, and this is just some common misconceptions about LMAPL. We've covered a couple of them. LMAPL enters soil pores just as easily as groundwater. This is not true, and I believe Sanjay in the next section will be going over how LMAPL enters soil and groundwater. You can recover all LMAPL from the surface. That is also a not true statement, or, pretty much a technically infeasible statement. All these statements, by the way, are false. So when I read them, I don't want you to think that they're true. Another statement, all soil pores and the LMAPL plume are completely filled with LMAPL. As I had identified, LMAPL shares soil pores with both water and soil vapor. LMAPL does not float on top of the water table or the capillary fringe like a pancake. And this is, again, something that Sanjay will be addressing. And some other, misconceptions that have been spread over the years that LMAPL thicknesses and monitoring wells can be exaggerated by a certain factor, and or when you have an LMAPL thickness in a monitoring well, that is representative of what the thickness is in the formation. Those are not true statements. Other things that we're going to be getting into, we had identified residual saturation, and we will further kind of qualify what is mobile and or migrating LMAPL over the course of this training. Another misconception, LMAPL plumes spread due to groundwater flow. That is not a true statement necessarily. And then lastly, LMAPL plumes continue to move long after the release has stopped. Actually, what we have found is that with a finite release, the LMAPL plume ceases moving in a relatively short period of time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sanjay on slide 21.
Thanks, Eric. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
All right. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. And just to remind you, we are on slide 21 now. And in the next couple of sections that I will take you through, we will see how LMAPL enters and distributes vertically in the pore space. And then Ian Hirsch will take us through on how LMAPL migrates, moves in the subsurface in the last section, which is section 4. So moving on to slide 22. So one of the root causes for the several of the misperceptions that Eric just listed is that we assume that LMAPL behaves completely analogous to groundwater. There are several similarities, but there are some important aspects that make LMAPL entry into a pore that already contains water, right? So water is already there in the subsurface, different than if water were just moving along a pore that had water, right? And we'll look at that difference in this section, that why is LMAPL entry into a pore different than water entry into a pore. We'll also look a little bit on the effect it has on LMAPL recovery. There's more coming in LMAPL recovery in part two of the training, which is next week, I believe, and we discuss a lot about hydraulic recovery of LMAPL and the right approaches and metrics, et cetera, for that in the classroom training, which, as mentioned earlier, is coming up in April. But now let's start by looking at how LMAPL enters the soil pores. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 23. So when a release occurs, the LMAPL displaces the existing air in the veto zone, right? And some of it gets trapped there as it's moving through the soil column. And if the release volume is large enough, the LMAPL will get to the water table. Once the LMAPL gets to the water table, it would first kind of start mounding there and then push down on the water table and distribute itself eventually in some vertical pattern. And also as it's doing that, it's initially spreading laterally also. So today we'll discuss both of these distributions in section 3 that I will cover and section 4 migration, which Ian will cover. The key point here is that the LNAPA has to displace or push out the pre-existing fluid, or pre-existing fluids, I should say, which are air in the vital zone and water in the saturated zone. Because the foreign thing that came in there is LNAPA. The other two fluids were already in there. So moving on to slide 24 is it's kind of explaining a little bit more about the displacement. So what do I mean by displacement of water by LNAPA in the saturated zone? So focus on the left-hand side figure first, the colored figure. And this is a blow-up of a pore scale. So you're basically seeing three or four soil grains, which are the yellow blobs there, or yellow parts of the picture. You can see the water, which is dark, brown, or black, is present in the pore throats, those little tight corners. And this is because the soil is preferentially wetting to water than LNAPA. That is, it prefers to contact water more than it prefers to contact LNAPA. And because LNAPA is non-wetting, it occupies the large pore, the larger part of the pore. And groundwater was already present in the subsurface before the LNAPA ever got there. So for that LNAPA blob to enter the pore or move in any direction, it needs to exert enough pressure to push out the existing water. So now focus on the right-hand side figure, which is a diagram. The arrow indicates the direction of groundwater flow, and the hatched shape is the LNAPA blob. As the water is flowing, it's exerting some pressure on the LNAPA blob, and in the top portion, enough pressure is not being applied, and the LNAPA is unable to displace the water out of the pore throat. So the pore throat is not letting go out of the water, and you're trying to push the LNAPA blob, and the pore throat is saying, no way. When more pressure is applied, which is the second half of this right-hand side picture, the bottom half, the LNAPA is pushed through the pore throat into the adjacent pore because you just increase the pressure a little bit more. So the top half represents a situation where the applied gradient is not enough to move or recover the LNAPA. And in the second case, the LNAPA is recoverable or it's movable, or it moves, under the gradient that's being applied or under the pressure that's being applied. And there's a threshold at which no amount of gradient or no amount of pressure would mobilize the LNAPA. This means that no matter how hard you pump, that there is some LNAPA that will never move. And that's called residual saturation. So this is another definition. Recall the sponge that Eric just talked about or showed? It's the same concept. At some point, you can't stress it enough for the LNAPA to leave the pore where it's at or move through the pore that from one pore to the next. Moving to slide 25. So that's conceptual. Now, how do I know how much pressure do I need? Right? So there must be there's a minimum LNAPA head that's needed to displace that water. And there's a term for it, and it's called the displacement head. Simple, displacement head to displace water. And first we'll use, at least on this slide, we'll use an equation and the framework that's based on force balance applied to capillary tubes to demonstrate which parameters are important. And then in real world, we don't use this to actually measure what that kind of displacement head is. There is a practical way to do it, and we'll talk about that in the next slide. So all parameters in the equation that you see over there, they are defined in the table. And the displacement head is dependent on the interfacial tension, which is the sigma on the numerator, and the wettability, which is measured by the contact angle cross phi, pore size, and density difference of the two fluids. So that's in the denominator. And the arrows kind of show you what effect each parameter has, and it's kind of straightforward if it's in the numerator versus denominator. The key parameter that's critical here is quite intuitive. The smaller the pores, the more tightly the water is held in them, and more difficult it is to push the napple into the pore that already has water. Moving on to slide 26. So what we saw in the previous slide was a fundamental equation, a fundamental approach applied to capillary tubes, which gives us a conceptual understanding of which parameters are important for displacement head. In practice, it's a measurement, and it's measured in a lab, and it's typically done for air-water systems, and then you can convert them to an LNAPL water number or LNAPL water system. So the way the experiment is done, basically you have a water-saturated soil column, and you try to push a non-wetting fluid, and as I said, it's usually air, can be LNAPL, it's usually air, and you push it at varying pressure. And the picture is shown, or the diagrammatic setup, the experimental setup is shown in the inset in the graph. The plot shows the results from three such different soils, or three such measurements for different soils. The output is plotted as head applied versus water saturation. So head applied is on your y-axis, water saturation is on your x. And let's just look at one set at first. Let's look at the blue line, the middle line, which is for a clay sand. Now imagine a water-saturated clay sand column in that picture, and you're trying to push air through it. Well, that graph's telling us that until the pressure is about 10 inches, the water saturation remains at 100%. That means you're applying pressure and nothing's coming out on the other end. And at about 10 inches, the first drops of water start showing up out of that soil column, which means that the displacement head for air for this clay sand is 10 inches. And then there are equations, simple equations to convert that 10 inches of head that's required for air to what head is required for LNAPL. And it's basically adjustment for fluid properties, so you account for interfacial tension essentially. The pink and the brown lines are for contrast and for concept for a coarser and a finer soil than the blue line. Right? So the take-home message is that there's a soil-specific threshold pressure below which the water is not displaced from the pores. Right? And that it's easier for LNAPL to displace water from the coarser sands, which is that pink line, than from fine-grained soil, which is the blue or the brown line. And there are databases and software available. You could go to the API website that has some information that have the necessary parameters to determine these capillary pressure curves. So going to slide 27. So why is displacement head important? What's the relevance? Displacement head is important because LNAPL needs to get into a pore in the first place for it to move or to be recovered. Displacement head, therefore, has relevance in vertical distribution of LNAPL. Its lateral migration or its essentially stability and its recoverability, because in all of those cases, you have to move LNAPL from one place, either vertically or horizontally. You have to move LNAPL from one location to the next. We'll talk about the vertical distribution and lateral migration both today, and Recoverability will be covered more in part two of the training next week. And finally, to summarize this section that we're just about to conclude now, is kind of very briefly, if I have to summarize all this, the NLAPL needs to overcome the entry pressure to enter a pore, or the displacement head, same thing. So it's not analogous to water flowing into a pore in the saturated zone, right? And if you have water going into a pore that already has water, it's just like moving into like or miscible flow. Whereas if NAPLA has to move its immiscible flow, it has to displace an existing liquid. And that kind of is the, so there are some fundamental differences when an immiscible liquid fluid tries to displace another liquid versus miscible flow. So moving to slide 28, so we'll change, shift gears a little bit here. So now this is section three. So if you're keeping track of sections, that was just about displacement head. Now we'll talk about how things distribute vertically in the saturated zone. What does it mean to see a thickness in the well? If you see a NAPL thickness in a well, what does it tell you? So diving further, going to slide 29. So this is, again, the same slide that you were shown earlier. Well, many of us have held the belief that LNAPL floats on water table in the capillary fringe. That is, it does not penetrate below the water table. So the mental picture that a lot of us have or have had in the past is that NAPL in the ground is like oil in a glass of water. Right? So that's something that the mental picture a lot of us have, or that when we see LNAPL in a well, we assume that all the pores in the formation are filled with LNAPL. And this is, as I said earlier, because we believe LNAPL to be completely analogous to groundwater. So we extrapolate our understanding of groundwater to LNAPL, and that's where the problem starts coming in. When we have groundwater in a well, the formation pores are all filled with water, right? So then we tend to think that I have LNAPL in the well, the pores next to it must be all filled with LNAPL. And the most common one that I'm sure we've all encountered or used, when I joined the industry, that wasn't uncommon to see reports that had some concept of this, which is that the LNAPL thickness in the well is exaggerated by some constant, 4, 10, 12, 2, whatever number, pick your favorite number, but there was some exaggeration. So let's look at what reality is and how does LNAPL actually look or distribute in the ground. So moving on to slide 30. So again, we'll divide this slide into two halves to talk through it easily. So let's first look at the left-hand side of the slide. This illustrates a common misperception that we just talked that LNAPL floats on top of the water and all the pores are filled with LNAPL as shown in the cube on the left-hand side, the bottom half of the cube. Bottom half of the picture, left-hand side. And this is also referred to as the pancake model. It does not represent reality. And based on what we know from site observations, lots and lots of data collected over several years, and also this fundamental physics, fundamental science that doesn't support that picture. Reality is closer to what you see on the right-hand side. And when LNAPL reaches the water table, it penetrates below the water level, just like ice cube in a glass of water, right? And in this zone, the LNAPL and water coexist and share the pore space. The amount of LNAPL that enters the pores is a function of the capillary pressure there and the pore size. And in the next few slides, we'll see how this pressure changes vertically. And what does the LNAPL in the formation look like, or how does it distribute once things have come to some sort of an equilibrium? The term we use is vertical equilibrium. And It's a fancy term, but all it means is when an apple comes to rest vertically. So imagine an ice cube being dropped in a glass of water, oscillates for a bit, and then comes to some sort of a steady state. And in that instance, the ice cube has reached vertical equilibrium. So same thing with an apple. It's not initially steady state. It's still moving vertically, laterally, and you just once it comes to a steady state, what does it look like? So we'll look at that. So just a bit of caution and a request for a bit of patience now. The next 3-4 slides are a bit detailed, and I ask you to just hang in there for these slides, and hopefully it will all come together when we kind of walk through these 3-4 slides that are related. In a normal classroom mode, you do it as an animation. Over here, you just have to walk through each slide at a time, so that's why there's 3 or 4 slides. So far, I have told you that the amount of L-NAPL in the formation is dependent on the pressure and pore size, right? So those two things are important. And now let's just establish how do I get that pressure, right? So we'll establish that vertical pressure profile. So it's a changing pressure, and we'll establish how to get that pressure profile when you have L-NAPL in the ground. So if you kind of follow the picture on the top, the monitoring wells on the left-hand side of the picture basically show a single well, and there are two conditions with the when that L-NAPL has well and when that well has L-NAPL and when it does not. Right? So the red's the L-NAPL, the blue is the water. And the red and the blue dashed lines show the L-NAPL table and the water table. Right? So now first let us focus on the well with water only. So mentally erase whatever's red on the slide for a minute. The corresponding water pressure line is shown by the inclined blue line. Right? By definition, the blue line is at atmospheric pressure, which is 1 atmosphere, at the top of the at the water surface, essentially. And at less than 1 atmosphere in the capillary zone, and the slope of that line is proportional to the weight of the water column. So folks that like equations, it's simple. It's that magnitude of that kind of pressure is essentially density times gravitational force times the height of the water column, right? Next, let's look at the red lines. So the red inclined line is the NAPL pressure line. Again, by definition, 1 atmosphere at the L-NAPL table, and its slope is proportional to the weight of the L-NAPL column. Same concept as the previous discussion about water. The only thing that's changing here is the density of NAPL. And the height, obviously, will vary because NAPL column will be at any given height or any given elevation, the NAPL thickness will be greater. The two lines meet where the pressure is the same. And the pressure will be the same at the bottom of the L-NAPL. And the fancy term here is the L-NAPL water interface. Right? So you have the same pressure at that place. As we had discussed, Eric said earlier, the L-NAPL and water coexist in the pore space. And because we talked earlier that L-NAPL cannot displace all the water, so they have to live peacefully together. So they coexist in that pore space. And when there are two fluids in the pore space exerting different pressures, there's the pressure at the interface, which is called the capillary pressure. And the capillary pressure essentially is the gap between the blue line and the red line. Right? So that's the magnitude of the capillary pressure. It's highest at the L-NAPL surface or the L-NAPL air interface and is zero at the water L-NAPL interface. Now we have a capillary pressure profile throughout the L-NAPL interval. I also request you to make a mental note of the two inclined lines because I'll refer to them later as well. Also, one more point to note is the capillary pressure is independent of soil type. Nowhere in this discussion I brought in soil type, right? If I have 1 foot of Ellen apple in a well, the red and blue lines will be identical for sand or for clay. So the capillary pressure distribution for a given thickness in a well is identical. So next we'll look at the capillary, what does this changing capillary pressure or the varying capillary pressure do for the Ellen apple distribution. So moving on to slide 32. So now I've taken a microscope and I'm looking at soil at pore scale. So I've got three cutouts. So look at the cutout A or the panel A, which is where the capillary pressure was the highest at the surface of the Ellen apple or Napple air interface. In this case, the larger and some of the medium-sized pores are filled with Ellen apple, right? Because the pressure is higher, you can get Ellen apple into some of the bigger pores and some of the smaller pores as well. As you come down to panel B, the capillary pressure is less, so there is less Ellen apple in the pores. Again, you have low pressure, can only get into the pores that don't offer as much resistance. And as you come down to panel C, there's no capillary pressure, so there's no Ellen apple. And it's reasonably intuitive, right? More pressure gets more Ellen apple into more pores. So the key messages here are the higher the capillary pressure, the more Ellen apple enters the pore, and higher capillary pressure is at the top of the Ellen apple surface, so you would expect higher saturations to be near the Ellen apple air interface. Moving to slide 33, and if you plot this information, the Ellen apple saturation variation with depth, so now combining the last two slides, we get this curve that is this blue line. And if you tilt your head a little bit, it looks like a shark fin, or just a bit of imagination. And the shark fin is based on a relationship called Brooks-Corey capillary pressure relationship. So recall that capillary pressure curve from a few slides back where I had the soil column and you're pushing air through it. That graph that we got from that experiment was the Brooks-Corey curve. And that curve helps us determine what Ellen apple saturation corresponds to a given pressure, because if you recall, it essentially had saturation versus pressure. So I can take that graph, and if I know the pressure, I can say for any given pressure, this is the saturation that it'll have. And when I plot that, I get this shark fin. So that's the detail. The key point here is that the Ellen apple saturations vary with depth, and they're never 100%. That is, the pores are never filled with napple because there's water that's existing, pre-existing. And this immediately tells me that I will overestimate mass or volume if I assume the pancake model, right? If I assume all the pores are filled with Ellen apple, then I will not have a correct handle on the size of the problem. And if I have an incorrect or at least a very conservative conceptual model, then my site's approach would not be suited for the site if I really don't have a good handle on what I have and how much do I have in the ground. And in the next few slides, we'll see how and why these shark fins or this vertical profile, if you use the more technical term, vary with soil type and with Ellen apple thickness and wells. Right? So if you go to slide 34. First, let's look, so again on slide 34, I used the old slide number. So first, let's look at the effect of soil type on a saturation profile, or the size of the shark fin. So in this particular example, I have 5 feet of gasoline in a well, and I'm estimating the shark fin, and ultimately the gasoline volume in the ground per square foot. Surface for different soil types. Let's first look at the pancake estimate, which is this background red. In this approach, we assume that the formation has the same thickness impacted as the well. And regardless of the soil type, all the pores are filled 100% with enamel. And that's where I get that red shape from. This gives me about 13 gallons of gasoline per square foot of the ground. And as I said, this is the pancake and it's not reality. Reality is that there's a distribution of enamel and all these saturations are, enamel saturations are less than 100%. So the figure also has the sharp fins and this volume per area for various soil types, but for the same measured well thickness of 5 feet, right? So the volume, so if you compare that 13 with the other numbers, the volume is half in gravel and more than an order of magnitude, 1/20th or so in silt when you compare to the pancake model. So why do the shark fin sizes vary by soil type? So if you recall from a few slides back, a couple of slides back, that the capillary pressure varies vertically, right? And it depends on the well thickness, but is independent of the soil type. That is the distance between the blue and the red inclined line. So that was about 2 or 3 slides back. When I said that, make a mental note of those. So the distance between those red, the blue and the red inclined lines is the same for all soil types. So the capillary pressure is the same at any given point vertically for all these examples, but the pore size distribution is different. So more enamel gets into the pores of a gravel than for a silt. And that's why we have three different shark fins for three different soil types. I'm going to slide 35. So kind of building that concept and how to use that information in real sites, that's what we're trying to do here. In slide 35, so if you look at the previous, not look at the previous slide, but in the last slide, we saw the effect on vertical profile with varying soil types, right, for a fixed enamel thickness. I had 5 feet, and I said what the profile would look like. In this slide, we are holding the soil type constant or fixed and changing the enamel thickness. So remember, we have defined the capillary pressure as the distance between the two sloping red and blue lines, which were the enamel and water pressure lines. You can visualize that, and as the enamel thickness increases, the two lines will diverge more, right? And the capillary pressure will be higher for a higher thickness in the soil frame type, in the same soil type. So, which means that the higher the enamel thickness, the higher is the capillary pressure. And the higher is the capillary pressure, because the pore size distribution is similar, it's the same soil, you'll get more enamel in the pores in this instance for a higher thickness. So that's why in this figure we see that the diesel peak, or diesel peak saturation in silty sand, which is the green, is 35%. And when that enamel thickness in the well is 10 feet, it's about two and a half feet, it's about 10%. And as you go less thickness to 1 foot, your saturation is 2 to 3. So basically, the higher the thickness, the higher the peak saturation or the peak capillary pressure, the max capillary pressure. And as a result, the higher the peak saturation in that profile. So that was conceptual. Now let's look at how does real world look. So I'm on slide 36, and these are two real life field measured profiles from work that was done by Dr. Huntley and Gary Beckett, and the data shown as so these are two different sites, and the data are shown as symbols, the triangles or the circles, and the not conceptual, but the calculated lines are calculated saturations are shown as those teal blue lines. Each number in the gray circle indicates a different soil type. So the left has one soil type and the right has six. So left is homogeneous, right's more real world. And the panel on the left side, the calculated profile actually matches the shark fin or the predicted vertical profile as well. I mean, this is the best I've seen ever. This is just perfect fit, a close to perfect fit. Whereas you go on the right-hand side, there are six different soil types, at least they identified six. I don't know how many are there. And the model does a reasonable job in predicting the peak saturation, which is at the top, about 40-50%. But after that, the model seems to not do too well. It just has some conceptual alignment with what the models, what you're observing in the field. So when you look at where the fourth soil type is, I presume that's a slightly coarser soil type, and you get a higher saturation than the others, and the model says you'll get a higher saturation, but it's still quite off. So the bottom line here is, in real world, things can get complicated due to heterogeneity, as you see here, or due to water table fluctuations, as we'll see later in some of the slides that will come up in a bit. But the take-home important message here is, and I'll tell you from personal experience, I've looked at these type of data for hundreds of cores, if not more, and several hundred of these profiles, and the basics have applied. I mean, it's never been the shark fin on the left, but the basics have applied. That means LNAPL saturation was never 100%. Saturation varied vertically, and lower prone soils seem to have the NAPL, and the tighter soils would have very little. So those concepts have already always been true at whichever site you look at. The modeling part, it guides the thinking, it explains the physics, but has limitations in terms of predictability. Going to slide 37. So far, we have looked at some conceptual drawings, the microscopic close-ups that we kind of had drawn, or graphs, like the shark fins that you saw. But how does it visually look inside the ground? So here are photographs of the same core in two different light conditions. One's white light, just ambient light, and the other is UV light. So the right-hand side picture is under UV light. The ultraviolet light just helps us see LNAPL better or easily. And the orange is essentially LNAPL, or it's showing where the higher, more LNAPL is. And you will learn more about this technique in part two of the training, and also a little bit more in the classroom. The percent fines in the soil are indicated in the white light photograph on the left-hand side, right? And the right-hand side picture shows corresponding LNAPL saturation. So what do we see? We see that the LNAPL saturation is about 15%, where the fines with soil with their lower fines, and a lower saturation where the soil has higher fines or more fines. So these two locations are only a couple of inches apart or a few inches apart. So the capillary pressure the same, but the saturations are quite different. Where you have 47% fines, you have only 3% saturation. We have 27% fines, you have 15% saturation. And it's not explained by the pressure distribution because they're only a couple inches apart. So again, we see varying saturations by soil type in this picture, and the saturations are less than 100%. LNAPA saturations. So going to slide 38. So what can I do with all this information in working on my site? So consider LNAPA body in the subsurface. And if you place monitoring wells, and again, this is an idealized picture, but helps your thinking. So if you place monitoring wells in different parts of that LNAPA body, those wells will have higher thickness in the core and lower thickness at the edges. And this assumes everything is homogeneous, et cetera, which in turn means more capillary pressure in the core than at the edges. That means a bigger shark fin in the core and a smaller shark fin at the edge. And so you have more mass in the core, less mass in the edge, et cetera. So that helps you conceptualize what the distribution of your source term, what the distribution of your LNAPA is at the site. And then you can design your corrective action, your mitigation action, your management action around that conceptualization of the site. So if you have a better conceptualization of the site, you can make better decisions. Moving on to slide 39. So we've been talking about vertical equilibrium distribution of the shark fin for several slides. And why is that important? So a few things here. You can overestimate mass. That's the simplest one, because if you assume all the pores are filled, you'll get a lot more volume. And I've seen reports, I've seen people calculate volume assuming that all the pores were filled with LNAPA. And there's a gross estimate of mass. And if you're lucky, sometimes they'll account for porosity. So second would be if you have, say, a foot of NAPL in gravelly aquifer and 5 feet in a silt, not only the migration potential in these two soils is different because one's tighter than the other, but the mass is different in both of these. The 1 foot gravel will have a lot more mass than 5 feet in silt. If you have wrong mass estimate, then it leads to unrealistic expectations of recovery. You're trying to recover mass that did not exist to begin with, or it could be reversed. You assume there's no mass in place, and you don't account for mass in a certain zone, and you may have mass because it's a coarser lens, per se, at depth, and it may have more NAPL than your shallower, tighter grain soil. And if you get the mass wrong, if you get your conceptual model wrong, you can get unrealistic expectations, unrealistic predictions, and non-optimal decision-making for other related issues such as dissolved phase concentrations. Right? And if you know, again, where your impacts are, then you can target your remediation system or your more accurately. So if you know it's near the NAPL air interface and it's a coarse soil, maybe you can drop your water level and do something with it, right? So recover or SVE. But if it's trapped below because of some of the geologic conditions and or water level conditions that we'll talk about later, then it might not be a readily recoverable situation and you might have to do something else. So again, it's more to help understand, develop a thorough conceptual model as needed to make appropriate remedial and management decisions for the site. Slide 40. So now that we know that all the pores are not filled with LNAPL and the distribution varies vertically, let's look at how to estimate the volume of LNAPL in the ground. And before you start collecting data and kind of come to the conclusion that you need to know the volume at every site, just urge you to have a good discussion with all the stakeholders on why you need that data, what decisions would it drive. because these are very rough estimates. An order of magnitude is, if you're lucky, an order of magnitude, I literally mean factor of 10, and can quickly become very expensive data collection exercise because you need very high resolution data to really do justice to this mass estimate. And in most cases, it may not be necessary to know what the total volume is, and it's just sufficient to know where the impact is and what is it, and you could start addressing it. But in some cases, maybe different stakeholder requirements or whatever the site drivers are, there may be reasons that you need to do a mass estimate. So with all that qualifying information I will talk about, one way to do mass estimates, I think we put it in here because that was a demand from some of the stakeholders who have that in the training. To do so, to go through the mechanics of defining or measuring LNAPA volume in the grounds, but I need to define one term. And I've used the concept before without defining the term. The term is specific volume, and it is the volume of LNAPA per unit area of the ground. So the units of this would be cubic feet of LNAPA per square foot of the ground. And you can convert it to gallons per square feet, but it's basically the same thing. And if you want to visualize it, you can visualize it as taking a square foot column, 1 foot by 1 foot column of soil, and extracting that column, all the NAPL out in a bucket. And now you'll have a gallon of LNAPL, was a certain amount of gallons of LNAPL in a square foot column. So that's what specific volume is. So going to slide 42. So let me walk through a process. This is one process of how to calculate our total volume. The first step, and I'll break it down into one, two, three, four, five steps. First step, you establish a vertical LNAPL saturation profile at some reasonable spacing at the site. All right, so these saturations could be measured in the field. And there are techniques, there are special labs that do that. And I think that's covered in part two and again in the lab on the assessment part of it. But you measure those saturations in the field, measure those saturations and it's field data. It's not assessed in the field. You collect samples, send it to a lab, et cetera. Or they can be modeled based on some of the stuff that I showed before. And based on what you saw with the heterogeneity and what I'll show you later, the modeling, you just have to do it with caution, but it can be. And that result is shown as the green shark fins. Shark fins, the ideal shark fins are for to say, those are calculated, and the jagged lines represent saturation, just for visual. But the green stuff there is the saturation profile. Second step is you would take these profiles and determine specific volume at each point, right? In this case, I'm calling them small V1, small V2, et cetera. So in the picture, the red circles are size proportional to the specific volume. They have no purpose in the calculation except that here, therefore, visual display the circles. But you have a specific volume at each of those boreholes. Then you can assign a representative area to each of these borings. And so you can say, you can do a grid, you can do Titan polygons, there are a couple other ways. I mean, there are different ways to do it, but you can say this area or this boring represents this area on the ground. And those are those dashed polygons that you see. Now you've calculated the volume, step four, you calculate the volume for each of these areas. Now you're just multiplying what you have before, A1, V1, A2, V2, et cetera. And the last step is you add all of that stuff up, right? So this is one approach. There are others. For example, you could contour your specific volumes, and then you can use the software to tell you what the total volume is. You could do a 3D interpolation of your vertical profile. So there are ways, and kind of slide has one. I've mentioned a couple others, and now we're coming up for a break. But just quickly to summarize what we saw, we saw that LNAPL distribution, the subsurface, is not like a pancake, and it's more like a shark fin, and in reality, it's more like a jagged something. It's a jagged profile of some kind. The size of that profile depends on the LNAPL thickness. So your peak saturation depends on your LNAPL thickness and also on your LNAPL type, on your soil type. And with this, I'll hand it to Juliana, who will moderate our questions.
Thanks, Sanjay. We are going to take a short break now for questions. So you're welcome to type in those questions using that orange question mark. If you're in the phone line, #6 to unmute and jump in with a question. Before we get to questions, I do want to remind everyone, at the end of the class, we do look for you to fill out the feedback form. So if you have to leave before we wrap up today, use that fourth button along the top to fast forward to the last slide. It includes a link to our feedback form. In addition to providing feedback that we appreciate, you also have the opportunity through the feedback form to create a certificate of participation for yourself. So be sure and check the box at the bottom of the feedback form so that you can receive that certificate if that's something of interest to you. From the simulcast audience, there was a large fuel release on a neighboring facility in the early 1970s, and we are still observing that the plume is migrating. Is that not commonly observed? You state that migrating usually ceases after a relatively short period of time.
Seems unusual. Things to look for are, so a lot of it will come later, but I'll throw out a couple things. Is the water level changed over time, or especially now, as you see it moving, is the water level continuously dropping? That can create a situation where LNAPL could actually move, even if it's old. The other thing that you'll hear in the next session is be sure that it's really moving, and it wasn't there to start with, and now it's just appearing in wells because of dropping water levels. So I'm generalizing. This is a generalized answer without knowing the details. It's hard to comment on it. Perhaps if that question's still there, maybe we can come back to it after Ian's session, because that's the session that talks more about migration. But just
Thank
a couple
you.
Thoughts to think about.
Can LNAPL be replaced by seeping rainwater again quite easily, because water is a wetting agent?
I have to think about it. Gut reaction, it shouldn't be. If LNAPL is trapped at residual, you'll again need a certain amount of pressure to, water pressure even, to move that LNAPL. So I'm assuming the question is more around the Vado zone. So you've had a release and it's trapped there, and now you have infiltration. Very unlikely that that infiltration will cause any kind of a head to mobilize the NAPL that's held at quote-unquote field capacity of the soil. But if that doesn't answer the question, maybe re-ask the question now or later.
How does the solubility and chemicals affect the shark fin?
They don't. Very important parameters, and you are hitting on something that we don't cover today. We cover a lot in detail in the classroom, and I believe in part two perhaps. Eric mentioned earlier this composition versus saturation difference, and so composition is important, but not for the size of the shark fin. For the size of the shark fin and the shape of the shark fin, the things that are important are the obviously the soil type, the capillary pressure, the fluid properties, not the composition. So interfacial tension is important. And density has a role. But Composition by itself does not.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this short question answer break. We do hope to have more time at the end to ask more of the questions. Please feel free to send in questions. Those that we can't get to, we will post after the training class and ask trainers to follow up. For now, let's continue on with the next section of the training on slide 44, and I'm going to turn it back over to Sanjay Garg at Shell Global Solutions.
Thanks, Juliana. I've got a few more slides to go before I hand over to Ian. So before the short break, I went over the vertical equilibrium model and like the concepts behind vertical equilibrium. Now we'll go over some cases where I'll tell you that whole shark fin stuff you need to forget. So, or we need to take caution when we do some of those idealized cases. So now we're getting in more into some of the complications of real world. Going on to slide 45. So far I've been telling you that well thickness is almost equal to the impact interval, right? So because the thickness or the shark fin essentially corresponds to the thickness is a little bit bigger, but for all practical purposes, it's very similar to the thickness. And yes, the pores aren't filled, but they are similar in the vertical interval, the thickness and the shark fin. But now we look at examples where to use caution when making that assumption as a default assumption. Right? That is that in some cases, the well thickness may not represent the impacted thickness in the formation. And the first one we will look at is a water table fluctuation. So this will partially apply to the question that was asked in the break, and hopefully it will make my response may have may make more sense here. So this slide, so I'm on slide 46. So this is a diesel plume in a coarse material, gravelly sand at a refinery. And these are series of screen graphs from a video clip that shows LNAPL thickness variation with water table over a 5-year period. So we're going from 82 through 87. And the red slash pink indicate thicknesses of less than a foot. And the yellows are about to 3 or 4 feet. So there's no way you can read that on there. But the yellows are 3 to 4 feet, and the pink is less than a foot. Right? Water elevation is displayed on the right of these graphs in that little bar. And it fluctuates about 8 feet seasonally. So we can see how the LNAPL thickness and the inferred footprint reduces during the high water conditions and kind of vice versa. So this would be LNAPL thickness in wells, right? So one key aspect to recognize here is that the LNAPL footprint and volume is essentially the same during the high water and the low water conditions. But it's apparent, or its appearance is different, and that changes our reaction. It changes our perception when LNAPL flows into well. And look at April in 1985 and September 1986 in the second row of these video clips, the first two on the left-hand side. They are 6-7 months apart. No, maybe more, but they're still, I mean, fairly close, a year or so apart. And one has a fairly substantial footprint, the other does not. And in both cases, the amount of NAPL in the ground is identical. And going to slide 47. So what I didn't say in the previous slide was, just wanted to challenge our thinking in what's different in 86 versus 85, or what's different in 85 versus 86, right? The LNAPL's up there, it's in the ground, but one gets more attention than the other. So going to slide 47, the relationship between water table and LNAPL thickness, similar to what we just saw, can be displayed by different types of hydrographs. And these hydrographs here are for different sites, but show similar information in different ways. So it was more to show it can be done. You can skin this in more than one way. Basically, what you're showing is when the water table is going down, the LNAPL thickness in the well is increasing. And this is common for unconfined conditions. When the LNAPL is unconfined, you'll see this behavior. So when you see LNAPL in a well, before concluding that it is a new release or it's moving, probably a good idea to see a hydrograph, see if the water table is doing something different. Note that the groundwater, the downward direction on the line in hydrograph B, so the top right side, that graph is LNAPL thickness plotted against groundwater elevation. So I'd ask you to just make a mental note. So what it's showing is as your elevation is increasing, your thickness is decreasing, and just make a mental note of the slope, the way it's directed, because I'll refer to that slope later again to make a different point. Going to slide 48. So why do we see this inverse relationship between LNAPL thickness and water elevation? What happens at a fundamental level? The panels at the top half of the slide, they show a water and LNAP, they show water and LNAPL saturations on the two axes. The bottom is water saturation, the top is the red the LNAPL saturation. And so let's start at the left-hand side. Let's start at panel one, and let's say that's time zero. That's our starting condition. We have certain LNAPL thickness in the well. And that you can see in the picture in the graphs at the bottom. So the LNAPL thickness is the red line, and you read it across the second y-axis. So we have a certain LNAPL thickness in the well. As the water table drops, some of the LNAPL gets trapped as residual saturation, so it creates a smear zone through the Vado zone. And so you see a slight decrease in LNAPL thickness. That's the first time the water table drops. And you may or may not be able to even discern that thickness because not a whole lot of volume that gets trapped there. But as you go to panel 3 and 4, the water table is rising again. As the water table goes up, the LNAPL gets trapped at a different residual saturation. So look at the red vertical thing at the Vado zone and the saturated zone. And when the water table rises high enough, there is no observed thickness in the well, so which is panel 4. And in panel 5, as the water table drops again, the LNAPL shows up in the well again. And in panels 3 and 4, also note that the LNAPL residual saturation is lower in the Vado zone than it's in the saturated zone. Right, so residual saturation is not the same for Vado zone and saturated zone. Those are different. Going to slide 49, and I'll connect those on the next slide. So if you go to slide 49, this slide shows residual saturations for different soil types for the two zones, the saturated zone and the unsaturated zone. Blue is for the unsaturated and the pink is for the saturated. And what I need you to do here is not look at the absolute values of those of the blue bars, but their relative size compared to the corresponding pink bars, which shows that for coarser soil types, when you have the sand, the difference between the two residual saturation is significant, but when you go to the silty clay, they're about the same. Right? What does this mean? That under low water table conditions or dewatering, some LNAPL will drain into the wells and be potentially recoverable in the case of coarse soil. But for finer grain soils, lowered water table conditions may not help you much in NAPL recovery. So if your remedy is to reduce the water table to make the NAPL available for recovery, that may make sense on the coarser side, but on the finer end of the spectrum for soil types, you may not get a whole lot out by dewatering the wells. You may not be able, and the reason is you're not able to actually dewater the formation at all. That's why we use how you can use this information. That's on slide 49. Moving to slide 50. In the last few slides, we've looked at water fluctuation effects on LNAPL or the LNAPL thickness in wells for unconfined conditions. So let's see what happens with confined. And we don't talk a whole lot here because of time constraints. Confined LNAPL can be more common than you think. Your aquifer does not have to be confined for your LNAPL to be confined, and I'll leave you with that at this stage and maybe can discuss a little bit more in question and answer, or as I said, we go into quite a bit of detail in class for that. But anyways, moving on, this condition, the confined condition, basically happens when the LNAPL reaches below a confining layer, just a slight contrast in permeability can cause that. And you're below the water table. And when you're at low water table conditions and you're unconfined, so in this particular example, you have gravel and then you have clay. When you have water level that's low, you're under unconfined conditions, right? So your NAPL behaves the way we've been seeing. But as the water level rises and the NAPL becomes trapped, then it becomes basically the well acts as a bottom filling pore, macro pore. And the LNAPL fills the well from the bottom. It's got a lower density, comes to the top. So you have this macro pore that's filling it. So imagine an inverted syringe and you have oil in it. That's what's happening in this particular instance. And if you go to slide 51, so this is a similar hydrograph, one of the hydrographs that we saw earlier, where you are plotting water table elevation versus LNAPL thickness. And typically what we are used to seeing for unconfined conditions is as the water table goes down, the LNAPL thickness increases, right? But for confined cases, it's the opposite. They track each other. As the water table goes up, the thickness increases because, again, it's a bottom-filling pore, and higher your water level will go, the more LNAPL will thickness will show up in the well. Again, think of a inverted syringe. And going to slide 52, just looking at an example of this from a site. So the well that we're focusing on for this particular discussion is this well in green, CASGB07. And then the nearby well, which is monitoring well 31. So look at the geology from that GB07, and the main point to note here is that at elevation of 800, the geology changes from coarse to fine, right? So you have coarser geology at below 800, greater than 800 you have clay. And so when the potentiometric surface is greater than 800, the conditions become confined. And when the potentiometric surface is below 800, the conditions are, or the NAPL is unconfined. So remember that 800 and the geology, and then let's go to the next slide, which is slide 53. And now this is the same hydrograph where I told you to kind of make a mental note of groundwater elevation versus LNAPL thickness. The first half of this picture shows unconfined condition. When you're below 800, you see the downward slope that I said, okay, make a mental note of. You see that behavior in that space. As the thickness goes above 800, or as the water level goes above 800, the napple becomes confined. Right? So as the water level is going higher and higher, the napple is trapped at 800 or so. The napple keeps filling that well. So the more the higher the water level, the greater the thickness of the L napple. So you can use these kind of hydrographs to actually infer if you have confining conditions or not. Sometimes they have been useful to even, you go back and challenge the geology. You look at the log and say, okay, there's something here that we didn't capture in a boring log, because the napple behavior is showing something different. Moving to slide 54. So here's some more examples where L napple is in wells is not representative of impacted thickness in the formation. And in all these cases, we're just assuming that the wells, somebody knew what they were doing when they installed the wells. And they are screened at the right location for the L napple to flow into the wells. The first picture on the left-hand top is unconfined, but the water table has risen over the years, and you create this long smear zone. So you may see a smaller thickness in the well, but your smear zone is a lot thicker. The second case is a purged. Here the L napple, as it was percolating down through the veda zone, it hits a fine-grained layer, it gets kind of purged there. And as the well is drilled through this layer and you install a well, the L napple may drain into these wells. And I've heard people say nobody would install a well like that, but when you have interbedded soils and your purpose of your monitoring wells different, you're not worried about the L napple and you're just looking, trying to get a long screen to just get a sample for your water. It happens, the situation can occur and it does occur at real sites. Confined, I'll skip this, we've gone over this in a bit of detail already. And the last one that says fractured, in a fractured system, the well that's installed is fed napple from wherever the monitoring well intercepts a fracture that contains L napple, right? And once that L napple starts flowing into that monitoring well, it'll keep flowing as long as there's enough napple. It'll keep flowing till the well is full, right? It'll go in, rise up due to buoyancy, and it'll keep filling. And eventually the thickness will be equal to where the lowest fracture feeding the well is. So although this picture is labeled fracture, you see this quite common in tight soils. So in a clay, or clay soil, you will not get pores that are filled with L napple because there's just the displacement pressure is so high. But the L napple will get into these macropores, root holes, desiccation cracks, etc. So that system, in principle, works from a napple perspective, works as a fractured scenario that's shown in the picture. And I'll show the pictures or examples of a couple of these in the next few slides. So going to slide 55. So this is kind of an example of the panel 4. And here there are two pictures from different fine-grained sites. On the right-hand side is a photo showing a network of fractures, how they would look like. The yellow bar there is a one-meter ruler, wooden ruler, so just for scale. And these fractures are basically macropores, and they are preferentially entered by L napple because they have a low displacement head. So if you go back to earlier when I started, it's just larger radius, a larger hole, easier for the LNAP to get into. So that equation with the capillary tubes, that applies here. On the left-hand side, we have a photograph from a Texas Beaumont clay. It's a site in Texas that one of our colleagues, industry colleagues, took. And it shows a macro pore with LNAP stain halo. So if you look at a couple of those three dots inside that circle, those are the little holes or macro pores that have the LNAP. The rest of the core doesn't have any LNAP. So you see three in that circle. There are a couple more on that slide. That's where the LNAP is. The rest of the core, you can take a sample and there'll be nothing. So a couple of points that can be made here, that LNAP is not distributed in the regular soil, like basic porous media type pores, as you would expect on porous media concepts. And if you took a sample for, say, TPH in this type of soil, and you're doing it every 5 feet, every 3 feet, whatever your predetermined interval is, you may not catch anything. If you miss these pores, macro pores, you'll still have a mystery on where you're getting your NAP from. So in both of these cases, if these NAP, these fractures, so coming back to our NAP story, these fractures are intercepted by a monitoring well. The LNAP will flow, and the well will act as a sump where the LNAP will accumulate, and you can have a large thickness of the order of 20, 30 feet, just depends on where the fracture is, and have very, very little recoverability. You take this NAP out, and it could take weeks, months, years to fill back up. So it should make us wonder why, how relevant thickness is in our decisions. Almost there with my slides, slide 56. This is an example of where the water table rose by several feet. There's a lot of information in this slide, and we do not need all of that information for the point I'm trying to make. If you could focus on the blue jagged line, which is the laser-induced fluorescence signal, a response just means that you have LNAP, and generally a bigger response means more LNAP. And again, this is part two training material. The red dots are direct measure of LNAP saturation. With the blue line and the red dots, if you look at them collectively, you can see that LNAP is present down to about 45 feet. And what we measure in the well is shown by two monitoring wells in that space, in that region, is of the order of 2 to 3 feet. So what happened here? When the release happened or occurred several decades back, the depth to water was about 40 feet below ground. So the LNAP went down to the then water table. And since then, the water table rose by about 25 feet because there's some changes in regional pumping, which smeared the LNAP all through this newly created saturated zone. And the only thickness we see in the well is this 2 to 3 feet. And if you predict a smear zone, soil impact, based on the LNAP well thickness, right? If I say about 2 or 3 feet in the well, that's where my soil column is impacted, then my conceptual picture would be quite wrong. And bottom line here is you can use thicknesses to calculate shark fin, but it's important to know the history, the hydrogeologic conditions, like the ones I've been discussing for the last several minutes, before you kind of make that assumption or start doing any of that modeling. The other thing that can complicate this picture is this site, because the NAP is in some coarser material, in finer material, could take several months to reach full thickness. So it's quite possible that this well could reach a 40-foot thickness if the LNAP were allowed to accumulate in this well. But because there's this constant removal or skimming but bailouts that are required, you never see that full 40 feet, but every 3 months there's this 2 feet that accumulates. and you bail it out and you go back again, and that's all the data shows. But if you did a proper conceptual model of this picture, you could probably get 40 feet of product, and you have to let it sit for several years for that to fill up. Last slide for me, slide 57. Just to summarize, we saw that L-NAPL has a variable saturation vertically, and it's never a pancake. In confined conditions, the saturation is dependent on the well thickness and geology. There are certain conditions, hydrogeologic conditions, where impacted soil zone is not correlated with the well thickness. For example, the perch, the confined, fractured. And in unconfined conditions, the water development increases in an increase in the observed thickness of that. Imagine that, think about that video clip that I had. And that in confined conditions, it's the opposite. Your water level, your potentiometric surface increases, your thickness increases. So, last bit from me, we so far, all you did, we did see was look at the vertical distribution. Now I'll hand to Ian Hirst of Golder to talk about how L-NAPL moves horizontally or laterally in the saturated zone. Ian?
Sanjay, thank you very much. Juliana, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Yeah, Sanjay has gone over a lot of the complicated concepts, so the last part, I think, will go relatively quickly as we discuss how L-NAPL moves. So we're on slide 58. Moving on to slide 59. There are some common misperceptions with how L-NAPL moves, and one, if you see it in a well, the automatic assumption is that it's mobile and migrating. That's not the case. The second, that L-NAPL moves along with the groundwater, kind of at the same rate. Now, well, that's not correct. And that L-NAPL plumes or bodies continue to spread and get larger over long periods of time. And based on the modeling and some case studies will show, that is also not the case. So moving on to slide 60. Well, this is a summary slide again of the issues for L-NAPL management and some of the considerations. And I'll just briefly touch on a few points again. One of the things I think we do quite well is vapor intrusion risk, as well as understanding groundwater risk. Those are shown there. We have an L-NAPL source zone, and of course we need to be cognizant and deal with those risk factors. We also have L-NAPL potentially moving towards a drinking water well, and there may even be potential for free L-NAPL or L-NAPL to move into that well, and once it's there, I think we just have sort of a less well-developed framework or understanding of potential risk associated with L-NAPL and wells. Certainly we need to be concerned about mobility, and I think that's sort of the main message here in this training, or one of the main messages, is how to get a handle on L-NAPL mobility and movement in the subsurface, because that there under point four is very important. And then there just may be aesthetic or regulatory concerns with L-NAPL in a well. So again, that summarizes some of the management considerations. Moving on to slide 61, another summary slide, a really important one with respect to potential L-NAPL movement and spreading, is that one requires L-NAPL to be above residual saturation. A lot of sites, we see L-NAPL at residual or only slightly above. The actual mobile fraction is quite small, and consequently the potential for movement or spreading is also small, and it also may not be recoverable. So that's, you know, the key point. L-NAPL potentially mobile or migrating only if the saturation exceeds residual saturation. Well, slide 62, I'm talk about Darcy's Law, and I'm sure everyone's heard about Darcy's Law and probably has applied it maybe in a groundwater study. But for L-NAPL, there are some differences, and really here we're dealing with a multi-phase. So L-NAPL and groundwater coexist. We're not just dealing with one fluid, but Darcy's Law actually governs fluid flow in this case as well. It's applicable to each fluid independently. And we're going to sort of explore that in subsequent slides. So this is slide 63 now with the nice colorful box there showing the multiphase. And we show the first two equations. We've got Darcy's law for water flow and then Darcy's law for LMAPL flow. And we have the subscript O, which is just for oil. Equations 3 and 4 really just relate the oil conductivity to a relative conductivity for oil, which we'll get into and describe in a moment, and either the intrinsic permeability, which is in equation 3, or the saturated hydraulic conductivity, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in equation 4, and then we have some parameters for viscosity, density, depending on the fluid. And those simple equations are incorporated in some models if you're using the API LDRM model or the older version of that model. Those are used to predict movement. Maybe just a practical take-home message is shown in the table there at the bottom right of the slide. And here we look at relative permeability and the effect on the oil conductivity. Well, as you can imagine, if you increase that, it's going to increase the oil conductivity, and that varies over many orders of magnitude because of the variability in geologic media. If we then move down, skip down to viscosity, if we increase that, we're going to decrease the oil conductivity. And then density, if we increase that, it also increases the oil conductivity, but it's not an important parameter. So really the key ones there are relative permeability and viscosity. Slide 64 is a slide to kind of look at the effect of viscosity. And the chart there, the figure on the upper right, shows a normalized parameter. Here we're just taking the ratio of the oil conductivity over the saturated conductivity, and we plot that using a model versus the LMAPL saturation for diesel and gasoline. And if we were to, for example, look at a saturation of 0.3, if we go from a gasoline to a diesel, we have about a 4 times difference, and that just is related to the viscosity. So diesel is just not going to move as fast in the subsurface. And also you, of course, can see the dependence on the saturation. So I think it's a fairly obvious concept here. Again, we're just sort of illustrating the importance of viscosity. Now, a practical, I think, take-home message here is that if you're at sites, often there are mixtures or there's weathering of products. So there are literature values, of course, for these. But we would suggest that a lot of sites, you take a sample and you could have that analyzed by a specialized lab for things like viscosity, density, and interfacial tension. Slide 65. Now we're getting onto relative permeability. Now, this is a key concept and really fairly simple. If we look at NAPL saturation, if we have high saturation approaching 100%, the relative permeability is 1. It decreases exponentially as the saturation decreases and the corresponding water saturation increases. And there are curves that have been developed, and for those who maybe have done a little modeling or interested in, there are models by Mueller or Burdine that are incorporated in some computer codes that allow you to quantify these relative permeability relationships. And conceptually it's important as well, just to understand how relative permeability varies. Slide 66, we bring the concept of relative permeability and the location in the LMAPL, site setting. So if we're looking at more of the core of the LMAPL body, here's where the saturation is higher. Consequently, the relative permeability is higher, and the potential movement is also higher. And we've sort of shown that analogous to two rowers, things can move faster. If we now move towards the periphery of the LMAPL body, the relative saturation goes down, consequently the relative permeability goes down, and the potential movement or velocity also goes down. And so it's important to look at the overall kind of LMAPL body. We can look at thicknesses. We know how important it is to interpret thickness data in the right context. Sanjay has gone over that in detail. But if you look towards the periphery of the plume, you're going to have less movement. You're also going to have capillary forces that constrain movement as well. Slide 67 is a slide that Sanjay showed. I'm not going to really go over it in detail, and it just illustrates that there's geologic heterogeneities. And here we just have zones where there's coarser grain soils, there's higher saturations, and consequently higher relative permeability and higher potential LMAPL flow rates. So you can see how in some geologic settings it's going to be a fairly complex or variable process depending on the geology and where those LMAPL zones are. If we now move to slide 68, here we're going to just go over displacement head and LMAPL migration. And I was alluding to this in terms of that the schematic with the rowers and the periphery of the LMAPL body. Well, if we move towards the edge of that LMAPL body, we get to a point where the thicknesses are small, the head is small, and it's insufficient to overcome that minimum LMAPL displacement entry pressure or displacement head that Sanjay spoke of for LMAPL to move into water wet pores. And that's why we have the red spot like there, is that that LMAPL body is functionally stable, and so there's no movement. And this is consistent with field scale observations. And this is an area of active research. It depends on the saturation, and things certainly are different in a system in the Vados zone where there's much higher air permeability, or sorry, air porosity, and consequently there's significant movement of LMAPL. But this is, I think, a useful concept, particularly plumes at the water table that are spreading. So water acts as a capillary barrier against the continued LMAPL spreading. Key point. 69, well, this slide brings together the two concepts, relative saturation. You see as we move from the core where the LMAPL saturation is high, the permeability is high, we're going to get to a point where it's lower. And then on the right-hand side, we just show the LMAPL body and where the LMAPL head is less than the resistive forces and there's no LMAPL flow. So this is a really important concept because I think sometimes we can calculate a theoretical mobility or seepage velocity for LMAPL. So I showed that Darcy's law. We can relatively easily do that. But it needs to be interpreted in the context of the overall kind of site conceptual model. Here's slide 70, and this is really just relating to the time aspect, another important aspect of your conceptual site model. So if you have an LMAPL release that occurred decades ago, the LMAPL head's dissipated, and it's small, you're really going to have a situation where you have a stable LMAPL body, because those the LMAPL head is just not sufficient to move LMAPL further into water wet pores. Consequently, there's no further spreading. And so that's where the time element is important. If you have a recent LMAPL release, conversely, you may still have some mobility. Slide 71 is where we're going to go over some case examples. Really, what I wanted to start with is just what we've observed. One thing is LMAPL can spread at rates actually higher than the groundwater flow if you have very high LMAPL hydraulic heads at the time of release. Another thing, LMAPL can move in all directions. It's not necessarily moving in the direction of groundwater flow. It will, but it, there may not be a preferential direction to LMAPL migration. It moves radially. And then finally, we do see that LMAPL bodies tend to come to stable configurations within relatively short periods of time. The first case example is the simulated LMAPL release. So this is a model simulation. It involved simulated release of about 1,500 cubic meters of product and the movement over about 56 years. So you can see how over you know, year one and even to year five, there's some spreading, but virtually no further spreading to year 56. For these simulations, a relatively small groundwater gradient was assumed, and the groundwater is predicted actually to move about 600 meters. And in contrast, the LMAPL spread about 100 meters. So just one example of the difference between groundwater movement and LMAPL movement and the time element to LMAPL spreading. Slide 73 is Interesting case study. It was an actual measured data at a pipeline crude oil release, and the upper left figure is a plan, and it shows kind of sequentially the extent of NAPL spreading. So we've got the gray zone, and that's where things spread between February 2000 and October 2001, so it's at about a year and a half. And then the blue and yellow zone is the additional spreading that took place in another year or so. So it shows that a lot of spreading occurred initially, and then some additional spreading. And if we actually look at the spreading rate versus time there in the lower right, you can see how the rate decreases. And it sort of tails off after a couple of years, and toward the end there is perhaps a few feet per year. So it was an interesting site because there was a lot of data collected. A lot of wells were installed early on, and it showed that time element, and it showed how that LNAPL body became functionally stable over a few years. The other line of evidence that was used for the site was dissolved plume study. So there were a number of wells just outside the LNAPL body, and again, samples collected over time, and that dissolved plume halo was also stable. And that's another indicator. If conversely it were to expand, that could be a line of evidence for your LNAPL body also expanding. Slide 74 and 75 are really going over a line of evidence evaluation for LNAPL movement, and there is ongoing work in this area, and so I'm really just going to touch on some things. We could spend a lot of time on each point, but first of all, we start with monitoring results, and it assumes an adequate well network. One of the practical things I find in data that I review is simple things like the well screen in the right location relative to the water table and the LNAPL body, the use of hydrostratigraphs, some tools to, more appropriately interpret data. But the things we're looking for are stable or decreasing thicknesses over time, sentinel wells that remain free of the NAPL, and a stable or shrinking dissolved plume, which I just referred to. The second line of evidence you could look at is a calculated LNAPL velocity. And so we know that's a theoretical estimate. One of the things we can do maybe to improve on that estimate is we can estimate that set, oil conductivity from a bail down test. And that's going to be covered in the module two of the LNAPL training. You could also estimate that from the shark fin model. And, of course, Sanjay has discussed some of the potential pitfalls with that. But essentially what you're using is Darcy's Law, and you're calculating a oil or LNAPL velocity. Again, remember, that's a theoretical velocity. It may just apply to the core of your LNAPL body. Moving on to slide 75. There is another model that some folks have been looking at. It's actually discussed in the LDRM guidance. That's, again, the API LDRM guidance. It's the measured LNAPL thickness required to kind of push LNAPL into a water-wet pore, so an unimpacted soil pore, based on that displacement head concept. And that can be related with some mathematics to the thickness of LNAPL in a well. It's based on a certain conceptual framework with the Brooks-Corey model, and there is some debate on that, on how accurate it is and whether it's actually really a conservative indicator, perhaps not. So just to be aware of that if you look at that further. Fourth is recovery rates. I think recovery rates are actually really valuable. Something we need to look at, decline curves. Is the LNAPL getting to an asymptotic point? Can we relate that back to the amount of mobile LNAPL left in the formation? So if that's becoming small, then I think potential for mobility is small. If we look at the age of release, weathering, another real kind of interesting emerging topic, natural source zone depletion and the influence of that on LNAPL mobility, which I think could be quite significant. And then finally, field and lab tests, we'll cover that in module two. So we're gone through the training, and we're just coming up to some summary slides. And So I know we've covered a lot of information. So first of all, with respect to the section I covered, LMAP velocity may be estimated from Darcy's law. A key parameter is relative permeability as a function of LMAP saturation. The other aspect of the conceptual site model is that the displacement pore entry pressure must be exceeded for LMAP to enter a water-filled pore. Then what we find is that once the LMAP release stops, the LMAP near the water table will eventually cease to spread as those resistive forces balance the driving forces the LMAP had. And obviously smaller releases will stop migrating sooner, and a continuing release, if it's not stopped, that will result in continued spreading, most likely. So one of the things we do see is that there are thickness variations of LMAP in wells, and that really could just be due to the effect of a two- or three-phase system and different saturations, and it doesn't mean that the LMAP body is moving laterally or spreading and becoming larger. Slide 77, here's the overall summary. I think Sanjay covered this really well with the LMAP being a multi-phase and not a pancake. It's not an appropriate model. LMAP saturations are controlled by soil heterogeneities. The specific volume, so if we do want to look at the mobile LMAP in the formation, it'd be greater for a coarse versus fine-grained soil. And as the LMAP saturation increases, the relative permeability and potential LMAP velocity also increases. Moving on to slide 78, we know that the pressure exerted by LMAP must exceed the displacement pore entry pressure to have LMAP move into that soil pore. And the measurable thickness of LMAP in a well is not a good indicator of mobility, and that LMAP bodies or plumes tend to come to stable configurations over relatively short periods of time. So with that, I hope this has been a really good learning experience, and I think we're going to give this back to Juliana for some questions.
Thank you. On slide 79, we have our links to additional resources. We also have our link to our feedback form. Looking at the links to additional resources first, if you'd like to go to the feedback form from there along the left, there's the link to the feedback form. We do look for everyone to fill out that feedback form. We really appreciate you taking a few minutes. And you can also get a certificate, so be sure to remember to check the box at the bottom of the form. If you forget, go back and fill out the feedback form again. There's not another way for us to get you that certificate right now. On the links page, I do want to point out the first link takes you to download the PowerPoint presentation. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information available in the notes section of this downloaded version. So I recommend that you download that as a resource. I want to get to as many questions as we can. For our simulcast audience, you're welcome to send those in using the question mark button. It's #6 to unmute the phone, so our phone line, please jump in with questions. Starting with a question that came in at the first question and answer break, how does the presence of macro pores, porosity from prior presence of roots, decayed material, burrowing by organisms, et cetera, in soil affect the soil conceptual model described? Macropores can extend through the soil profile to the water table or in the solid bedrock interface. This type of porosity can both vertical and horizontal components, especially in distributed soil columns.
So, Juliana, this you said came in the first break, and if we had read it then, I would have said that the answer is coming up, so hopefully we discussed it in the second half, and if there's still questions, maybe they resubmit or email me or something. That's, that was the macro pores and fractures, that's what we're discussing in quite a bit of detail.
Although we cannot use a specific factor to compare the amount of LMAP in the well to the amount of LMAP in the subsurface, there's obviously some correlation. So is the rule of thumb that more LMAP in the well equals more LMAP in the subsurface still valid?
So I'm trying to look for slides. Look at slide 38 and 39. So more LMAP in the well. So this is for unconfined conditions, more LMAP in the wells, for a given soil type means more LNAP in the formation. So that's slide 35. More LNAP, similar LNAP in the world, different soil types, you really can't say. You have to account for soil type. For confined conditions, more LNAP in the world does not mean more LNAP in the formation. It just means your water level has risen higher. I'm trying to do shorthand answers, so hopefully we can get as many questions, but if that doesn't answer, feel free to send me an email.
Our next question refers to slide 33. So along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can jump back to slide 33. If the tip of the shark fin is at the same vertical elevation as the top of the LNAPL, then what does the top of the shark fin indicate? In other words, how can there be LNAPL saturation if there is no LNAPL present?
Okay, I think if I understand the question correctly, the two inclined lines on slide 33, I think and I believe that they should stop at the top red line. So I probably got carried away when doing this conceptually. The NAPL saturation above the red dash line, so which is the NAPL air interface, that's a capillary fringe. So there the NAPL also gets up into the capillary fringe a little bit. So there is that little bit of the shark fin that is above the NAPL air interface.
What impact do floods or heavy rain snowmelt have on LNAPL hydraulic head and spread rate and the LNAPL footprint?
I think, Sanjay, you kind of addressed this a little bit in that question in the first session.
Yeah, I thought it was pore entry pressure. You have to have the pore entry pressure exceeded, which is not easy to really have the NAPL mobilized. I think the problem is on the reverse side, actually. When the water table drops, that's when you get the migration.
Unless the properties of the LNAPL are changed somehow, and of course the technology used is hot water flooding and rarely used, but that if changes the interfacial tension or properties of the LNAPL, then there can be induced mobility.
Thank you.
With regards to the regulatory environment, what about providing historic LNAPL plume stability as a possible route towards closure? Is this what you would all refer to as the measurable level left in place?
Can't speak to the regulatory framework, but yes. So if your plume is stable and you can show it over time, that feeds into your package for closure that the NAPL is in place and it's not moving over time. And yes, there is NAPL in well that it's, and I'm getting into what Ian talked about. It's mobile, but it's not migrating. Ian, you want to add to it?
No, I think you've covered it well, Sanjay.
Doesn't seasonal fluctuation in the water table present the potential for misleading LNAPL thickness because the water column is higher than the screened intervals of the well?
This was in the first break, Juliana?
Yes.
So I think we answered that, discussed that quite a bit in the second half where we talked about water table fluctuations. The only new part in here is if your screen gets submerged, there is that potential that you do not capture all the LNAPL if your LNAPL goes across the screen interval. But a lot of the water table fluctuation effects we talked about in the second half. So what I'm getting at is a lot of the questions basically were asked in the first half, and that discussion, a lot of that discussion happened in the second, so I'm not sure how much more to add at this stage.
Got it. We have a couple of questions that ask for additional references. One says slide 33, what is the RTDF 2005 reference? And another question asked if we could have some bibliography information about learning more about this information.
Good. So in the interest of time and without having to go through my literature, I think a couple of good starting points. One good starting point could be if you go to the API website and search for LDRM, LNAPL Distribution Recovery Model. It's a model, but the documentation for it is more than the model. It's a lot of theory and a lot of fundamentals in there. And one could use that as a starting point, and the references cited within that to start building on what was covered here. Ian, anything overview type document that you can think of?
Well, the ITRC document itself is a great document.
That's
and
true.
It has references. It,
yeah.
In 2009, I think, or I forget exactly when we published that. So, I mean, there are maybe a few more recent publications out there, but it certainly covers a lot of the principles.
I could add a couple things to that. Specifically, there was a question about the, this is Eric speaking, about the 2005 RTDF document. That was put out by RTDF, which was organized through EPA, and the name of that document was A Decision-Making Framework for Cleanup of Sites Impacted with LNAPL. In addition to that as a reference, on the ITRC LNAPL team webpage, if you click on resources and links, there are, you know, a dozen or so various publications that are provided on that website.
Thank you. And to access that LNAPL team page, our links to additional resources list that as the fourth one down, so you can access it there. And one final question for today, does the historic presence of LNAPL change the pore entry pressure compared to soil not previously encountered with LNAPL?
Good question. So this whole concept of pore entry pressure only applies when LNAPL is going into a pore with water. So if you have LNAPL continuous body, LNAPL moving into a pore with LNAPL does not have pore entry pressure, right? So if you are pumping, for example, and you're pumping from location A, and it's a continuous NAPL body to location B, not stream, but the connected pores of network that have LNAPL, LNAPL will flow through those that network and will not have entry pressure. So the concept of entry pressure is only into not necessarily pristine, but into a pore that has water.
Thank you. We are out of time. We actually ran a little bit over. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining today. If you sent in a question and you feel like we did not answer it, please send that to me at training@itrcweb.org. You can respond to the registration confirmation and reminder emails to get that question to me, and we'll post it to follow up with the trainers after the training class. Also, if you are interested in talking with the trainers directly, their contact information is available on slide 4, so that's another way to follow up. Thanks again for attending today's class. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. We do use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. If you have not already, please sign up for Parts 2 and Part 3. Also, if you know you're not going to be able to attend Parts 2 and 3 and you are registered, I do ask that you go ahead and cancel. We have a waiting list for those classes as well. More information about ITRC, including the new LNAPL update team, is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.